Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Ethnographic Marginalia. We're excited to be joined today by Dr. Javier Augero, professor of Latin American sociology at the University of Texas at Austin, where he also founded the Urban Ethnography Lab. Through a couple decades as a political ethnographer, he's focused on urban marginality, collective violence, contentious politics, and environmental suffering, with most of his research in marginalized neighborhoods in Buenos Aires. His publications are far too many to name, but among my personal favorites are the books Poor People's Politics, Patients of the State, and most recently, The Ambivalent State, Police Criminal Collusion at the Urban Margins, which he co-authored with Catherine Sobring. Most importantly, and Javier, I noticed that this hasn't yet made it onto your faculty page, but this is an error you can correct once we finish recording, he's on the advisory board of Ethnographic Marginalia. Javier, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sneha. Thanks, Alex, for having me here.
It's so good to do the show with you, and we're very excited for this conversation.
I'm excited too.
Awesome. So, you know, let's just jump right into it. And the first question that we thought we would ask you is something that Alex was actually telling me about, that you started out studying law, right? So we were curious to know how you became a sociologist and what drew you to ethnography in particular.
You know, I don't think I ever told that story. As a young 17-year-old in Argentina, as many other kids, also still in Latin America and in Europe, you have to choose a degree. You don't have the experience of college in which you can jump from one subject to the next and then decide on what you're going to major in. You have, you're finishing high school and you have to choose your future. And my dad was a lawyer. He was also a politician. And so I said, well, I'm going to go in for law. 3 years later, and many memorizations of codes and Roman law, et cetera, that bored me to death. I thought it was time to quit. But the explanation is a relational one. I was also by then in my second year in law school. I was also an activist doing work in poor neighborhoods, teaching kids literacy classes, trying to organize soup kitchens. The kind of things that activists, grassroots level activists, still do. And I met two young sociologists. I had no clue. I really had no idea what sociology was. But I found them fascinating characters. And I, as an impressionable 18, 19-year-old, wanted to be like them. Wanted to, you know, listen to the music they were listening, dressed like them. I have no shame in saying this. It wasn't an intellectual choice back then. It was more what you would call now a lifestyle, if you will. You know, the beard, the kind of, again, the kind of clothes, music, books, I spent 3 years, 2 or 3 years reading law, and I was really not very well versed in literature or social sciences, and I had a lot of catching up to do. So it is a much more sort of complicated story, but I went back. I started zero again. Now I was a little bit older, and I started sociology at the University of Buenos Aires.
Okay. That's really interesting. How did ethnography happen to you?
As you just said, ethnography happened to me, because I wasn't, in my work as an activist, I would spend a lot of time in these neighborhoods. But also, it was a friendship thing. I would go with friends. We would, play music, organize things, do, movie nights in the neighborhood. This was a time when democracy was, coming back to Argentina. There was like our spring, our democratic spring, so to speak. And so there was a flurry of activity. It was fun to be in politics. So but then I was doing my, sociology studies. I was reading my Marx, Weber, Durkheim, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. By year 3 or 4, I had to take a class on qualitative methods. And I, in retrospect, I realized that the professor was either lazy or not very knowledgeable. But his whole thing was, first day of class, you're gonna learn ethnographic methods by finding either a marginalized person or a marginalized space and go and hang out there. That was the directive. Nothing else, right? Go and find out what is going on. Like we would now call the sink or swim approach, right? I end up hanging out with a group of kids who were, smoking weed and drinking in another poor neighborhood. Actually, 10 blocks from where a soccer star recently deceased, Diego Maradona, was born in Villa Fiorito. That's where I did my first ethnographic stint, hanging out with this group. And I had I would not teach like that, but I would come back and take notes. I would do recordings. And eventually that was my first ethnographic project. And I just loved, and I never, until much later, I never conceived of another method. Of course, I had to take, required stats at the university for coursework. But I always thought, oh, this is how you do sociology, because the two friends that introduced me to sociology were also ethnographers. So I never thought about, oh, sociology might be something else.
And what the sort of first experience of ethnography, where you're hanging out close to the birthplace of Maradona, what were you doing with these people other than drinking and smoking weed? I don't know if you were participating, but what was the project?
More...
You don't have to answer that.
After the first 2 or 3 visits with them, I started thinking, okay, what exactly do I want to find out? There were issues of, addiction. There were many other things. For example, their relationship with the local police. I slowly started zooming in something that was very much present at the sort of political and intellectual climate of the time, which is how do people learn to be citizens? Again, this was the time of, democracy coming back to Argentina. So did they know their rights? Did they not know their rights? What kind of citizens were they? Did they have aspirations for the future? Way later, I learned about a book, Ain't No Making It by Jake McLeod, that did that way much better than I was trying to do back then. But that was the idea of the project about, were they citizens or not? Did they think of themselves as citizens or not?
So to shift into talking about your dissertation research and first book, which is Poor People's Politics, which is still hugely influential, 20 years, nearly 20 years after it was published. You studied Peronist party brokers and clients, right? Now, how did you come to that project? I remember you saying that was actually even related to to your activism?
Mm-hmm. It was related to my activism because I've always, you know, I was an activist, and I wasn't an activist, you know, a Peronist activist. So I always wonder why were we so unsuccessful in recruiting people to our own cause, and why was Peronism so successful? That's a question that still, you know, it's still around in my mind. But the way in which I arrived to the issue of patronage politics had a more sort of, I always knew, as I just said, that I was going to conduct, my research was going to be ethnographic. Now, fast forward to grad school. I'm at the new school. I'm taking, again, classes. I'm reading Habermas and I'm reading Foucault. You know, discussions on civil society were big back then. And on my own, I'm reading someone who was little known at the time at the new school that then became, you know, very influential here in the U.S., of course, and that was the work of Pierre Bourdieu, who I first found at the University of Buenos Aires. Back, I think it was 1994, a young sociologist comes to the new school gave a talk on boxing. That was Loïc Vacant. And I remember I had no interest in boxing. I had a huge sort of interest in the work of Pierre Bourdieu. But I remember the one thing that stuck in my mind was that how you actually can find a specific social universe in which you can conduct a research on the stuff that interests you, right? And so I was reading on power and on habitus, but I was like hunting for like, where can I actually study these things, right? What specific set of relations, it was used to call sort of relational setting or specific social universe in the case of Loïc. And, you know, my interest in politics plus my hunting for this specific social universe plus my readings on, you know, politics around the world that I was doing at the new school, started thinking, what is this universe of patronage of clientelistic politics that nobody in Argentina had been talking about? I mean, it's hard to convey this, but the word clientelism and patronage politics was nowhere in the political or academic lexicon in Argentina back then. And so I decided, what if, you know, Peronism could be studied in a very different way through the lens of patronage and clientelistic politics. I wanted, as a young Argentine academic, the last thing I wanted to study was Peronism. I came to the U.S. I said, I'm tired of everybody studying Peronism. And I hit my head on Peronism, you know, 6 months, less, you know, 2 months into my field research. But I came to that out of interest in the world of, you know, boxing, takes on habitus, and concerns with the workings of power. That it was more a sort of intellectual lineage. And this is not a retrospective sort of reconstruction. It was, I think it's the closest thing to how actually happened. I remember sitting, you know, with my books and trying to draw something and trying to, you know, circle around, okay, how do I study this? Where do I find these relationships? And I started thinking about, you know, the people I knew in Villa Jardín, Villa Paraíso, which is the place I ended up doing fieldwork, because I before coming to grad school, I did a short sting as a sort of social worker, trying to recruit old folks to join a social club. That I was, you know, I was trying to, you know, make some money, and so an NGO hired me to do that. And so I got to know that shantytown pretty well out of my work with old folks. And so I decided I'm going to go there and try to figure out what kind of political relations are there.
And just for our listeners, you mentioned that sort of Peronist activism was more successful than maybe more traditional activism or some of the kinds of things you were trying to do. What is Peronism, or what was Peronism, and you know, what meaning did it have for the lives of people in these marginalized communities?
No, the thing is that, I mean, I'm not going to try to define Peronism, but it was a, you know, it was and still is the largest political party in the nation. It had an appeal among the poor, even when, you know, many, many years after, Perón's government, in 1983, it was out of the government. Peronism did not win the first elections, the first democratic elections in 1983, but it was still very popular, and people would vote for them, even if, you know, the candidate was a crook, even if the candidate's policies were not progressive. They would still, you know, some of them, not all of them, would still. And I was trying to understand the appeal of Peronism in poor people's politics. I end up, you know, trying to think through what Peronism still means for poor marginalized people. It means a claim for dignity, for recognition, along the lines that, you know, many years before me was highlighted by Daniel James in his wonderful history of Peronism. But I was trying to figure out, okay, you know, I ended up honing on the issue of problem solving. What kind of problems Peronism is addressing and solving for these people? And I ended up doing my research exactly on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to shift gears a little bit at this juncture and say that, you know, as in your trajectory as an ethnographer, you've done research in a bunch of different ways. From poor people's politics to, say, patients of the state, where you hired research assistants, to collaborative works with people, and even with community insiders in Harm's Way and in Flammable, mm-hmm. to your latest book with Katie Sobering, who was a student of yours. So mm-hmm. we were just curious about these different models for ethnographic research and why the changes in the models, and if you could say a little bit about how it was to collaborate in terms of, you know, doing ethnography.
You know, if subjects could convey the reasons why we do things, I always say nobody would need ethnographers. And I'm probably not the best informant on why, how these things actually were decided. And that's why, among other things, I don't go around trying to come up with a name for what I do. These days there are so many names and so many qualifiers for ethnographer. Every ethnographer feels the need of coming up with a name for what they do. I'm more traditional, or maybe I am a little bit more knowledgeable on the history of ethnography and in anthropology and sociology to know that those names have been around for a while, and now we are sometimes reinventing the wheel. But going back to your question, poor people's politics was, in that sense, traditional ethnography. I did it on my own. Then I did something more along the lines in contentious lives, in in-depth interviews and oral histories, and then I did some in-depth interviews and statistical work for the Gray Zone. My heart was always in ethnography, but I also had to recognize the fact that I had to spend more time here, away from the field, from domestic responsibilities. I had to kids. We had two kids. To professional responsibilities. I had to, you know, be here, you know, teaching, et cetera, et cetera. Prevented me from, like, I'm going to spend a year and a half in the field again, as I did with poor people's politics. Still, I toyed with the idea, I'm going to do this. I don't know how. And in the case of Flammable, I started doing solo field work. And a week into that field research, one of my sort of informants, it wasn't my quote unquote informant, it was someone that everybody sort of recognized you had to talk to this person, because he's the president of the neighborhood association. So I start talking with him. First thing he mentions is, do you know Deborah? And I said, no, I don't. Oh, she's an anthropologist. She lives here. My first reaction was like, damn, there's someone actually who moved into the neighborhood and is doing the real thing, right? Doing real anthropological work. It wasn't the case. It was like Deborah was born and raised there. She was teaching English classes. She was finishing her degree in anthropology. And again, I don't want to get too sort of causal on this because I don't really know what prompted me to start this collaboration. But I had, back then, I had sort of the privileges of time and that come with tenure. And so I said, let's start this. I didn't know there was a name, quote unquote, for, between quotes, native anthropology. I didn't know that. I thought, I'm not going to do this alone. There's someone who is interested in this. We started this conversation and we agree whatever we're going to do, we're going to do it together. It took longer than expected. I didn't have a clear plan. I do believe that, you know, as Henry Petrosky says, form follows failure. And so I'm sure we failed a zillion times. What ended up being is, I think, someone can call it a model, you know, for doing collaborative work. But I don't want to put that name, or I don't want to say, oh, people should be doing that. It just so happened that I found someone, and she found me, and we found each other that we could work together. Then I decided, okay, if I want to keep doing ethnographic work, because I do trust ethnographic data, I do trust, you know, looking at what people do and what people say and what people say in relationship to what they do. Another silly of those dichotomies that people make up about, you know, what they say and what they do and what do we trust. This, you know, anyway,
yeah.
I'm now sounding like a cranky old person, but, but what I thought is like, okay, you know, if I was able to pull this off with Deborah, I'm going to try this again. I knew someone from my activist days who was working in another poor neighborhood, and we ended up doing in harm's way. So things happen. I think it was Zora Hurston who said, that research was curiosity formalized. I think it was, you know, I'm now reading this wonderful book, Gods of the Upper Air, which is the history of cultural anthropology in the US and the Boas Circle. And I'm pretty sure it was her who said that, you know, research was curiosity formalized. I was curious about the issues of the environment and or violence. And I said, okay, how do I go about finding more about this? Let's team up. And I wasn't concerned about, oh, how will co-authorship or primary informantship will look like. I do know that, you know, in some other times, Deborah would not have been the co-author. She would have been acknowledged as a primary informant and move on. And I don't want to claim, oh, I'm a good person. It just happened that, you know, I established these relationships and I cannot conceive of another way of doing these things.
So I think this is a really interesting point because, you know, your first project that you talked a little bit about, that's like very much the dominant way we think of ethnography, right? Like the mm-hmm. lone wolf in the fields alone, going out each day, this, you know, what I do, what Sneha does. Can you talk a little bit more about like what the process was when you were working with Deborah in Flammable or in Harm's Way? These are people who actually lived in the area, and you're in an American university, right? Mm-hmm. In mm-hmm. Texas by that point, I think. Mm-hmm. What, you know, is this, are you talking a lot on phone? Are you going and visiting? Are your collaborators sending you field notes? Are you deciding together what to do? How did that work?
It was on the nuts and bolts. They were quite different. In Flammable, I was still at Stony Brook. There was a time before WhatsApp, and there was a time before all these ways of communicating that we had now. So we would do this via email. I would go and stay, you know, go there for a month, visit, get the lay of the land. And so we started thinking, okay, Deborah, why don't you keep a journal of your own activities in the neighborhood? Let's try to start thinking about an interview protocol. Okay, here is an interview Deborah will send me via email. What do you think about that? Why don't we ask this? And we would go back and forth, and I would read her diary, and then she would read the diary to me when I visit with her at her home, you know, 6 months later. It was, again, you know, if I had to write this as a model for doing ethnography, I would probably come up with like a much more organized and put some order in what was kind of at the time of chaotic and let's try this, or why don't you try this? You know, for me, it is obvious not to ask people why they do things. For me, it's a question that I try in my teaching to tell students, don't do that. But then I do it when I'm interviewing someone, and Deborah did that and says, so Deborah, why don't you try this? Or why don't you try this other thing? The same thing with the photographs. We did an ethnography workshop. Her sister is a photographer. And so say, why don't your sister teaches these kids the basics of photography, and we ask them to portray what they like and what they don't like about the neighborhood? I didn't have a theory. I mean, then I read, Bourdieu wrote about diagrammatic representations of space through photography. And there's a long lineage of, you know, visual photography. I would be lying here if I say, I had a clear idea of what visual sociology was, and I tried to implement that. As a funny anecdote, I was back then the editor of Qualitative Sociology, and Doug Massey submitted an essay based on photography. And I was like, and this was a photography taken by immigrants on what they think the US is. And I was like, I'm doing the same thing in Flammable. And I actually, you know, sent him a note saying, you would think I'm stealing your ideas, but we're doing the same thing in Flammable. So there was a lot of, again, I could formalize this and get, you should do this, you should, the shoulds and shouldn't do it. But at the time, it was, let's say, you know, theoretically informed intuition, right? I want to get at images of space. Remember one thing, that the advantage of Deborah doing the interviews is that I still have the transcriptions in my office, of course. The level of intimacy that you get talking with your friends and neighbors is something that, you know, even the best ethnographers struggle to get at. That presents a problem, is that every interview was 3, 4, 5 times longer than I'm used to listen and code, right? But it has the advantages of like, there is a gem of, you know, there's an insight here that I would not have gotten otherwise. So at some point I said, okay, Deborah, let's only ask about this or that. What do you think of this or that? And then the collaboration in the analysis and the writing was also a back and forth. I'm not ashamed to say, I was very much wedded to the idea that there was something, I still have a file with that title in my computer. There was something called toxic doxa, right? I was married to this idea that there has to be some sort of toxic adjustment to the environment. And Deborah would fight against me. It's like, there's no doxa here. The first thing she would say, what exactly do you mean by doxa, right? Okay, why don't you read this, Deborah? So she would read it and said, this is not coming out in the interviews. This idea of, you know, theoretically driven ethnography sometimes has the issues, like you're trying to fit something that the data is not responding to. Is not, you can, I do believe in constructing an object and producing data, but sometimes, you know, in the interviews it doesn't come like, this is taken for granted. And Deborah would say, that's the other thing, and I'm going to stop here, but that's the other thing, is that when you work alone, and you know, in your writing of ethnography, you can actually get away with a lot of things that if you're working with someone from the neighborhood, you won't, because Deborah would not allow, say, you're not saying that. This is not, and so Jack Katz has this idea that informants contest your interpretations of the data. That is absolutely true. But it's also true that when you have, you know, someone from the community writing with you, they would contest even before, as you're thinking, not as you're writing. Mm-hmm. Not when you, after you write it.
That's really, really interesting. And as I'm sure Alex and I are both now writing up our own ethnographies, and there is this tendency to be so attached to a theoretical framework, or like you want to say the snappy, you know, mm-hmm. some snappy phrase, but it's not actually bearing out in the data. So it's good to know that you've also had to think through this. So
absolutely. It happens. It happens all the time that you do start with this a very strong idea, and even you move on with a strong idea, and then you write a paragraph that you it sounds wonderful and it makes perfect logical sense, but then the data are telling you something different. Not the data as something totally outside of your own construction. I'm saying your field diary, the voice of your informants, a transcription. Some basic thing, you know, all the theories about violence, like, exposition to violence, exposure to violence, say, end up familiarizing yourself to violence you take for granted. Well, if people talk endlessly about violence, that's an indication that it's not taken for granted. So
My reaction to that is I'm actually thrilled that there isn't someone holding me accountable in that way.
You do have more freedom. You do have more freedom. That is absolutely true. I had not fights, but it was fun. And again, when you have the privilege of not having the pressure to publish or to send something out immediately, you can enjoy those moments in which you're like someone is telling you, but Javier, this is not what I'm seeing. And I say, well, but this is what the literature tells you what you should be seeing. Well, I'm not seeing that. So, this is, for me at least, this is the fun part. I know it creates a lot of anxiety, of course, but when you are over certain, you know, thresholds, like, okay, I have time and I'm going to think through this, right?
So I wanted to pivot to, I think it's really interesting the way you describe sort of that model of research, which developed maybe somewhat accidentally, but I think it's really valuable sort of to hear how that worked. But a different model in a different book, Patience of the State, which is a solo authored book, but I think you used paid research assistants. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
And how did that, just quickly, it's an ethnography of sort of waiting in these Buenos Aires welfare offices that the many of the poor are sort of going to get needed resources, and they end up just having to wait indefinitely. And I think the argument is really fascinating. But how did that work? I guess one question I have is, how did you come up with that idea without actually, were you there first observing and then decided
to hire
people?
When we were finishing Flammable, I vividly remember being, and I think I wrote about this somewhere and I can't remember where, but we were having lunch at Deborah's house. And out, from the kitchen comes the mom of Deborah, sort of pretending she was an older lady than she was, and walking on a cane that she was not walking on a cane. And she starts saying, like in an old frail voice, "We're gonna be relocated from Flammable," like making fun of the fact that they've always been waiting for relocation and nothing happened. And that was one of those, moments of Lily King, the novelist, would call it euphoria, like this euphoric moments in which like, what is going on here? What is this waiting about, right? I start rereading the interviews, and there were a lot of moments in Flamel, there were a lot of moments in which people were like, we're waiting for this, we're waiting for that, something will happen. And I started thinking about this waiting as the experience that marginalized, and I started thinking, maybe this is not just only about flammable. And I don't have the mind of, oh, I'm going to test this theory. I'm going to create this model. It's like, well, I start asking friends who are like in Argentina, it's like, where do people wait? And I remember Sheila Birker, who is now a pollster, and she's very successful and very good at what she does. Like, you know, you had to try the welfare office. And then another friend end up being, you know, Agustin, who is from Ecuador, but who's studying in Argentina sociology, says, you know, the people, the line where people wait for their IDs. And I created this, like, and I'm going to revisit Flamel. I create this, okay, where are these, again, specific social universes where people had to wait? Now, I had no set of theoretical tools to think about time. And so what I did is, as I was thinking, and in this, you know, it's not like a model. I think this is how ethnographers work. As I'm thinking about a design, I start gathering work on time and waiting. Of course, I reread with that idea Pascalian Meditations, the last chapter, which is about that. In Pascalian Meditations, Bourdieu uses the work of Kafka to think about time. I start reading Kafka. My wife says, you're thinking about waiting? Of course you have to wait, because she knows a lot about García Márquez. You have to wait. Nobody writes to the coronel, because it's all about waiting. And then I start gathering whatever came to my, you know, novels, social theory. I went back to reading, Schwartz and Q's, E.P. Thompson on the meaning of the clock. And I start creating, as much as ethnographers create their data, they also create their library. And I created a little library that since then had been disassembled for some other project on time and waiting. And so for a while, that was the only thing I was reading, on time and waiting. And you start seeing, when you're doing the interviews, you start paying attention and observations. And this is, I did hire people because there was no way, this was the year I was transitioning, I think, yes, the 2 years I was transitioning from Stony Brook to UT. I talked to my friends, I hire research assistants, and start thinking about questions and observation protocols to find out what waiting did and meant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting, all of this, and it's lovely to hear you talk about your work, because I can almost sense like the ethnographic enthusiasm, you know, and it's very relatable. But I was actually curious about, you know, you've been an ethnographer for a couple of decades and you've published so many books and articles, but we were wondering if you could tell us a story from your fieldwork, whether it's embarrassing, funny, sad, exciting, but one that's sort of slipped through the cracks, or one that you've never really shared, at least publicly. And you know, we would love to hear that if you wanted to share with us.
I have many embarrassing moments. one of them, I mean, I just mentioned in passing one of them. I had in Flammable, I had this concern as to, okay, this is a truly miserable place, and I knew from reading newspapers that that a group of neighbors were organizing a squatter settlement, and they were saying, we're leaving Flammable because nobody can live here. And so I, at the moment, I thought this is a perfect natural experiment. You know, why are people leaving and why are people staying? If the conditions are the same, this is perfect for someone who is interested in social movements, why this happened. And I had this really silly idea of asking them straight directly, why are you not leaving? And people would look at me like, what kind of dumb question is that from an old, bald guy, as I learned I was in Flammable, when I knock at a door and the little kid comes out of the, in the patio and says, Mom, there's a bald guy here. Like, this is the first time someone called it in my face. But then I ask, why are you not leaving? And this is the kind of things that, you know, I keep telling students, one thing is are your questions. The other thing is the question that you ask, because then you get all these pre-constructed, you know, responses or blank stares. And but a more sort of embarrassing but sort of deeper thing that happened is when I was doing, and again, I don't think I ever said this, this in sort of public. I was doing my sort of long oral histories, but also a little bit of ethnographic observations here and there for Contentious Lives. I was not at all prepared to, I was trying to reconstruct the history of the story of these two women's participation in contentious episodes. And they start telling me stories of domestic abuse and violence. And I had no clue. I honestly had no idea of how to react to what I was listening, what to say. I felt, I wasn't trained in that. I wasn't, it's not that I was not aware that there was a problem. I wasn't expecting. It came totally out. And then not only I was able to navigate that, but then when I had the stories and I was confronting with just the paper on the stories, I had no tools to interpret that. And I had to really struggle to intellectually also and emotionally to make sense of it all. And you know, when you read the, I think you still read the book and says, oh, this makes sense. But it was agonizing to me. It's like I had no idea how to handle this, how to interpret this, how to write about this. Do I have any right to write about this? It was also the first time that I knew that the two women were going to read what I had to write. And so it was a back and forth between my own interpretations and what they would think my interpretations would say about what they went through. So it was really, really, really hard. And again, you know, years later comes all this, you know, concern with positionality and reflexivity that I do respect that, but this is not the first time that people have been thinking and struggling over this. So, so yeah. And then I had many other embarrassing moments in which, you know, I was almost mugged and through humor and being scared, I managed to navigate that too, but that's it.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned this briefly in passing, so I wanted to kind of go back to it. But you said something about teaching and the kinds of advice you give students when you're teaching ethnographic mm-hmm. methods, I assume. I was curious to know, what are some of the texts that you like to teach with, and why mm-hmm. these texts in particular?
You know, this is another, not funny anecdote, but I've been teaching readings in ethnography, both, you know, just the sort of the foundations of ethnography, but also the sort of nuts and bolts for ethnography for a long time, and for more than a decade. And I never actually thought about formalizing how I taught until I asked, Richard Osejo asked me if I would, you know, contribute a piece on teaching ethnography. And my first reaction was, there's no way I'm going to write more than a page about this. But, you know, very aware of my own limitations of, you know, formalizing and putting, you know, in paper how I thought ethnography should be taught. I asked Katie Jensen, now at Wisconsin, if she thought it was a good idea, like, we would talk and we can collaborate in a paper on teaching ethnography. And the paper was just published. I think it's a great paper. She is the first author, because as you can sense, I'm not very sort of systematic and organized in presenting my ideas. That's how my mind works. So I always admire Chuck Tilley, because he would like point one, point two, point three, very organized, very clear. I wish I could be like that. But going back now to your question, I choose, and I'm now in the process of doing exactly that, of choosing 8 or 9 ethnographies that illustrate the warrants, the puzzles, the balance between observational data and interview data. What is a good, you know, again, puzzle or enigma? Are these ethnographies capturing well the native point of view? How's the narrative like? You know, a set of questions. I think there's 5 or 6 questions that are right up on the syllabus, and I ask the students to ask the same questions over and over again to 8 or 9 ethnographic texts. And so I include, you know, some now classics like Death Without Weeping or In Search of Respect, but then we move on to, let's say, Matt Desmond on the Fire Line, or I am now including Life Exposed by Adriana Petrina, or this fabulous book on African doctors. I have it right here. It's called A Heart for the Work by Claire Wendland, Journeys Through an African Medical School. I also include Pedigree by Lauren Rivera. I mean, the list goes on and on, and I always had to Farine Parvez on Islam in France. It's a sort of mix of things in which, you know, the students are asked to ask the same question over and over again. They can disagree about the virtues of that particular ethnography, but by the end of the class, they know that a good ethnography has to have at least one warrant, clear puzzle and enigma, trying to capture the point of view and how people think and feel, some sort of balance between the kind of evidence that is presenting. That's how the idea is. I don't like to teach ethnography through the process of sink or swim. How I learned to do ethnography, I don't think I would advise that. So I think the whole idea of a class on ethnography is that the moment of the construction of an ethnographic object is the most important one. Way more than when you actually, you know, the specific operations that you do in the field, because they're actually wedded to that construction of the object. So, and I try to use really what I think are exemplary texts on how you actually do that. See?
Can I take this class? It sounds excellent.
Well, I'll say that
it sounds more promising than I'm actually presenting.
No, it sounds great. It sounds I was actually taking notes of the books that you were mentioning to sort of pick up after this. So thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and I've read the article that you and Katie wrote, Katie Jensen, and I think we can recommend that to our listeners who are interested in teaching ethnography as well, that it is a really interesting reflection on exactly what you're talking about. To go back to actually writing ethnography, and maybe for sort of a last question, is that I think both Sneha and I are really interested in sort of creative ways of finding data and presenting data within ethnography. And that one thing we appreciate about your work is that you you draw on novels. And, you know, back to Patients of the State in particular, there's a lengthy analysis of the trial by Kafka. Mm-hmm. Actually, you use fictional work in teaching as well, even in the class that you mentioned, that I've had the pleasure of taking. You use a story by Borges on mm-hmm. Funes, this man with an amazing memory, but who, you know, struggles to focus in on things. And I think you've used that in your writing as well. Mm-hmm. Just to be provocative for a moment, why should we consider novels or fictional works legitimate evidence for a book or for an article? And why did you make those choices?
You know, I mean, there's no one answer, right? I mean, the one thing is, I love reading fiction. When I was writing my dissertation, I would spend, you know, a few hours reading. I remember back then this is 1997. I was really into Paul Auster, and I would read that. And I recommend students to read fiction because that's the best way. Reading is the best way of learning how to write, right? And so I have a soft spot for fiction, not only because I'm married to someone who writes fiction and she's a literary critique, but also because I do think that, again, going back to Zora Hurston, she used to call, and she was one of the sort of anthropologists from the Boas circle. And again, this is because I'm just rereading Gods of the Upper Air. She used to call what she did literary science. And she was doing ethnography, right? And literature has an insight on, you know, on human experience. And I don't use that as ethnographic evidence. I use it as a way of sensitizing me to understand things. I honestly think, and I would say, you know, Bourdieu in Masculine Domination uses Wolf, and in Pascalian Meditations uses Kafka as insights into the experience of A, what being a woman feels like, and B, what the experience of waiting feels like. And then you confront that with ethnographic evidence. And I think it makes for a better text. I also, going back to what I said before, I also think that maybe it is my own sort of limitations because A, English is not my first language. And now I don't write well in English and I don't write well in Spanish. So I always struggle to ways in which, you know, you can present your arguments better. And I had to, and I'm not ashamed to say, I had to work harder. I do read fiction for fun and for sort of enrichment, but I'm also reading because I know that I get into the rhythm of writing better when I'm really steep into that. If I go, it happens all the time. I go to Argentina a few months, I stop reading in English, and then I come back, and I had to struggle. I'm not a natural for language. I have friends who can speak three or four languages with ease. You know, I'm not ashamed. You know, he's a good friend of mine, ethnographer Dennis Rogers, who goes, you know, between French, Spanish, and English. And he's like, how does he do this? And he's a wonderful writer too. And it's like, God, I wish I could, you know, and this, I would not say this in public, but when some of my students complain about, I'm having difficulty in writing, and they're English speakers, I look at them like, you have no idea what we go through. So maybe I have a short fuse I have low sort of patience and tolerance for complaints about, I'm struggling with the writing. Like, really?
Yeah. No, I completely, as you were speaking, I was actually thinking about the time that I was writing my dissertation, and all I read were novels alongside. And I probably, again, shouldn't be admitting to this because I was supposed to be reading like sociological theory or something. But honestly, like 90% of my reading time was spent with novels because, again, I was like so self-conscious that it's not my first language and I need to construct these elegant sentences.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Sneha, I think, and Alex, I think we would agree that you wouldn't learn how to write well only reading sociology, only reading...
Never.
Even less so from anthropologists who these days tend to write in a more and more obscure ways. I fantasize, and I still do, about writing like, whatever you think about the book, it doesn't... I mean, we would agree that Catherine Boo's Behind the Beautiful Forevers is a wonderful read. And I was like, I want to write like her. And I actually... If you read In Harm's Way, you'll see that the first pages, or at least the first pages of one of the chapters, are trying me and Fernanda as nonfiction writers. I cannot sustain that for more than three pages. I go back to the sociological writing, which is a lazier writing, I think. It doesn't, you know, require much of our imagination. Anyway.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I love ethnography that reads more like a novel. I think that's a great message that we should all be reading novels.
Yeah. And, you know, this, so much of what you said today was so relatable, and I'm sure it's going to strike a lot of resonance amongst our listeners. And thank you for sharing so candidly. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. And I just wanted to say thank you for taking time out. I know that you're busy, and I know that you're giving a talk a few hours after this.
Yes.
So this is particularly appreciated that you took time out today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me here. Really, it was fun to set in sort of semi-public things I'd never dare to say in a lecture. Thank you.
There were a few points where you said, this is not something I would say publicly. And I was wondering if I should remind you that we were recording a podcast.
No, I know. It's fine. It's fine. It was.
We appreciate your honesty.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, Javier, with whatever you're doing now, and all the best for yet another quarter of teaching and teaching ethnographic methods, I suppose, in a time when you can't actually do ethnography outside the way one is perhaps used to doing.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me again. Thanks, Alex and Neha.
Yeah, thank you, Javier.